Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Language. The argument from the poverty of the stimulus has been highly influential in shaping modern linguistics. It claims, in essence, that we must have innate knowledge about language in order to explain how we learn it so well, given limited exposure. In their book, Linguistic Nativism and the Poverty of the Stimulus, Alex Clark and Shalom Lapin take a critical look at this claim. In this interview, we discuss some of the forms of the argument and the various ways in which computational results about the learnability of languages are interpreted and misinterpreted in linguistics. Today I'm delighted to have the chance to speak to both the authors of the book Linguistic Nativism and the Poverty of the Stimulus, Alex Clark and Shalom Lapin. Perhaps I could begin by asking you to introduce yourselves and say a little about your work.
My name is Alex Clark. I'm in a computer science department, but I identify more as being a theoretical linguist. The research I've been doing for the past, I suppose, 10 years now has really been focused on problems of learnability, in particular how one can learn the sorts of richly structured representations you need to describe language from data, and various theoretical and technical issues that are related to that, but always with the ultimate goal being to explain language acquisition and apply these ideas to the fundamental problems of linguistics.
I'm Shalom Lapin, and I'm a professor of computational linguistics at King's College London. And I sort of move back and forth between computer science and linguistics, although my home is in a philosophy department. My background is in computational semantics, and working with Alex, and also before Alex, with Stuart Schieber, got into computational learning theory about 6-7 years ago. And my collaboration with Alex resulted in the book that you're interviewing us about and several papers in chapters and handbooks. And I'm interested in the whole problem of what kind of learning biases are necessary, how much one has to assume as built into the learning procedures and algorithms in order to account for both grammar induction, that is syntactic learning, and semantic learning. And I've of late been working on probabilistic and stochastic models of both syntactic representation and semantic representation in the context of the learning theory work that I've been doing with Alex.
So how did this book come into being in its current form?
It started really, it grew out of a course we taught together at the Summer School of the Linguistic Society of America, which was in Stanford in 2007. Shalom and I decided to teach a course which was basically about the applications of learning theory and recent advances in computational learning and the relevance of these ideas to the long-standing debates in theoretical linguistics about linguistic nativism. So we taught that course together, which I found a fascinating experience, and then subsequently we decided to turn that into a book.
Right, and I had done some earlier work, which grew out of some applied machine learning research that I had done with colleagues at King's on topology for dialogue. I'd been impressed at the effectiveness of machine learning methods and had sort of thought for years I'd worked with a kind of two-world view that you use machine learning for engineering and classical sort of established conventional models of theoretical linguistics and the theory of language acquisition that Chomsky had introduced 50, 60 years ago for your theories of cognition. And the work I did on machine learning convinced me that, in fact, a lot of engineering work might well have cognitive significance and import for the way in which we at least might in principle be able to learn. And so I sought out Alex, who is an expert in computational learning theory and mathematical modeling of the machine learning paradigms that I had been using. And that produced a very fruitful cooperation, which reached fruition in the book.
Well, indeed. Turning to the book, then, you begin by outlining some of the competing positions on linguistic nativism. And in particular, you associate these with the rationalism-empiricism debate in the history of philosophy. But you also argue that these issues are actually orthogonal to one another. Why do you feel that the confusion or the conflation of these issues is so widespread in linguistic theory?
Maybe I'll answer the philosophical part, and Alex can come in and clarify and correct. Yes, I we do argue in the first chapter of the book that the rationalism empiricism debate, as central as it is both to philosophy of mind and philosophy of knowledge and cognitive science, is in fact very different from the nativism debate in linguistics. And the reason for that is that as we take it, the rationalism empiricism debate is about what constitutes the source of knowledge one has about the world and where one can achieve certainty, whether one can achieve knowledge through experience or through first principles in reasoning by deductive models from first principles. Whereas in the nativist debate, one is really looking at, as it's been formulated in linguistics, the question of how many very specific domain-particular constraints on the language acquisition procedure or algorithm do you have to assume in order to account for the actual achievement of human language acquisition within the limits of data and time and computational resources that are available? And that's a very specific empirical problem, very central to cognitive science, but very different than the rationalist empiricist debate, although there are points of contact that go back as far as Plato. Plato's sort of poverty version of the poverty of stimulus argument, as he presented in the case of the slave boy in the learning of geometry, but we see these as essentially different questions. The reason they got, we think, sort of tangled up is in part because Chomsky insisted on characterizing his position as a Cartesian position, which I think is not an accurate representation of the history of ideas. He was, in fact, presenting an interesting empirical claim about the nature of learning, which is quite different than the Cartesian or the rationalist enterprise, but that association stuck and became sort of embedded in linguistic tradition. And it was our task, we thought, to disentangle it and also to reformulate the nativist, anti-nativist issue as a computational problem, as well as a psychological issue, which could be rendered a little more precise in terms of what was entailed in investigating it and trying to solve it.
So you focus then on the poverty of the stimulus argument itself, which you present various articulations of. Perhaps we should make clear at this point exactly what that argument is taken to entail within the various contested ways in which it's used.
Alex?
Yes, I mean, I think the question of exactly what the poverty of the stimulus entails is surprisingly tricky at the moment. I think certainly in the 4 or 5 years that the book has been, between when we started work on the book and today, there's been some significant shifts in the views on what precisely the argument entails. In the book, we take a fairly classic view that that it entails linguistic nativism, that it's one of the strongest arguments for linguistic nativism. And we take linguistic nativism to be the view that language acquisition proceeds primarily through mechanisms or knowledge which are domain specific, so specific to the domain of language, rather than proceeding largely through domain general mechanisms, so mechanisms that might be used for the acquisition of other types of non-linguistic knowledge.
Yeah, Alex's last point is particularly important, is that we want to distinguish the issue of a poverty of stimulus as an argument for domain-specific learning biases for grammar induction, for language acquisition, from the general question as to whether learning requires, in general, human cognition and learning require constraints and biases. And it's often been assumed by critics of empiricist views that there are no that a data-driven approach to learning doesn't require learning biases or learning priors if you're in a Bayesian framework. But in fact, that's not true. And we were at pains to point out, as have others before us, that no self-respecting empiricist would ever claim that there are not a fairly rich set of learning biases and mechanisms which are involved in organizing human experience. The question is how much of this is particular to specific domains of cognition, how much is learning partitioned into modules, if you want to use a kind of metaphor that Fodor uses, and to what extent can you use more general learning algorithms and procedures that are just sort of weakly tuned to data from particular areas. And it's the latter view that we were most interested in exploring as a viable alternative to rich theory of universal grammar as a domain-specific set of conditions on acquisition.
Of course, taking up that point, another ground on which empiricists or empiricist approaches are sometimes criticized is that they secretly encode a lot of learning biases whilst claiming that they are not making unreasonable assumptions about the nature of that process. I guess the question is, to what extent the algorithms in question are genuinely domain general?
Yes, I mean, I think that's a crucial point. I think when you have a particular algorithm, then one can examine it, and if it's capable of theoretical analysis, you can see the extent to which there are biases. One can identify the exact biases, and then you can debate whether they are specific to the domain of language. Of course, ultimately, the most convincing way of showing that an algorithm is not specific to language would be to apply it to some non-linguistic domain. Perhaps another area of cognition, like you know, music or some sort of sequence of motor actions, or learning chess, or possibly even to some completely non-human aspect, for example, learning DNA sequences or something like that. So if you had an algorithm and one could apply it to a variety of problems, then it's clearly not going to be domain specific. However, I think that's probably too much to ask at the moment, given our current level of understanding. I think there's often going to be some minor biases that are specific to language, if only from the point of view of how we implement or define the algorithms. It might be possible later on to see to what extent one can trim away or prune away those domain-specific assumptions. But I think it's fair to say that most of the algorithms that we use at the moment do have embedded in them some quite domain-specific assumptions. The question really is, do we have just a small sort of homeopathic dose, if you like, of that? Or is actually there a very, very substantial amount of bias in these algorithms?
Just to develop one aspect of Alex's point, and also a point we're concerned to make in the book, is that it's also important to, when you were evaluating an algorithm, a learning algorithm for bias in the case of grammar induction and language acquisition, to avoid formulating poverty of stimulus arguments in a way that becomes vacuous or lacking in any kind of interesting content. And one prime example of such a vacuous formulation is one in which you assume a particular theory of syntax as the correct description, often without argument, when there are really good alternatives. You then show that this particular theory of syntax, which may and often does posit fairly abstract structures and a very powerful set of computational devices, is unlearnable from available linguistic data, primary linguistic data within the limits of time and computing power available to the child. And then say, presto, nothing up the sleeves, we've established the poverty of stimulus, when in fact what you've done is shown that a particular theory of syntax is perhaps not accessible to efficient learning under constraints of time and data that are available in primary linguistic data and the learning acquisition device. So we try and sort of factor out that approach from a more interesting and substantive version of the poverty of stimulus argument, which we take to be the original one and the one that's worth discussing, where in fact you leave fairly open what the characterization of the properties of natural language are, and you try and work out as broad and as empirically substantial an account as possible, and then see to what extent you could get a class of grammars that would represent these agreed properties without assuming an elaborate formal structure as given.
Yes, I mean, if I could add one thing there, I think you touch on an important point there, which is the class of representations that you're going to be using to represent the knowledge of language, so typically a class of grammars. So I think a very good example of the debate would be if you have an algorithm for learning, say, context-free grammars, which are a particular rather simple formalism for representing syntactic structure, which were introduced by Chomsky in 1956. Now, from one point of view, one can say, well, it's impossible to have a completely domain-general algorithm for inferring context-free grammars, because the representation of context-free grammar is intrinsically something that is specific to the domain of language. But though context-free grammars were introduced as a model of syntax by Chomsky, they have also been used extensively in non-linguistic areas. So, for example, to model DNA structure, to model hierarchical planning in classic AI.
To
model a whole range of other things. So on reflection, one can see the assumption one's using a context-free grammar is not, I think, really a domain-specific assumption. But when we look at it, though it was introduced specifically as being a linguistic construct, when we zoom out a little bit, you can see that, in fact, it's something that's really quite domain general.
Yeah. And very often formal objects of syntactic representation, like tree structures or other kinds of graph theoretic objects, which are treated as domain specific, can themselves be learned by biases which, while they might be prior constraints on a learning algorithm, can in fact come from broader cognitive domains. They can be used for example, to model mereology, that is, part-whole relations that give you a kind of recursive tree structure pattern that's useful in things like navigation or in visual object recognition in whole part structures. This is a point that was made even in a debate between Pinker and Jackendoff on one side, and Chomsky, Fitch, and Hauser on the other, with Jackendoff and Pinker pointing out that hierarchical recursive tree structures are omnipresent throughout cognitive domains. So simply arguing that they are characteristic of a class of syntactic representations doesn't, and that you need to assume some element of such structures as priors or learning biases on the range of hypotheses of what your representation is going to look like doesn't commit you to a strong domain-specific position. A lot of work in learning theory, particularly by various kinds of Bayesian learning theorists using fairly strong data-driven empirical methods of learning, probabilistic methods, have shown that you can obtain rich syntactic representational structures with internal recursion in this more domain-general way, from more domain-general priors.
Turning back, if I may, just briefly to the question of the theory internal argument, the poverty of the stimulus, as you discussed earlier in that answer. And my impression was that you consider it plausible as an assertion in the book that the, let's say, a transformational grammar is not learnable, and that the argument for the poverty of the stimulus actually would work if you assume that there must be transformations in that example, and certain other particular kind of deep structural manipulations. But you make the point that that could be taken as an argument against the validity of the grammar, just as much as an argument against the for innate biases. One thing I was rather curious about is, as you remark, there are various other grammar formalisms which wouldn't necessarily encounter the same problem, and which have good coverage, good descriptive adequacy at least. Why do you think it is that the versions that are problematic, for which the internal APS is still current, have so much traction, so much sort of visibility in the literature?
I think that's in many ways a result of historical and sociological factors in the field. So that Chomsky himself proposed the poverty of stimulus argument fairly early on, at least in the early to mid-60s, it became a very powerful argument in a particular view of grammar. One of the bases for the claims is that the kind of transformational syntax that he was proposing was not efficiently learnable from data. And I think that the importance and prestige of his work has carried that argument, whereas other theories which have dispensed with transformational operations achieved far greater formal explicitness and computational viability have often been sort of relegated to, let's say, specialist niches, theories like head-driven phrase structure grammar or various kinds of categorical grammar, particularly combinatorial categorical grammar, which can be shown to have not only a high degree of descriptive adequacy, but also a fair degree of expressive power within fairly constrained mathematical and computational limits, but never become achieve the level of influence, one, because they're highly technical, and also, I think, simply because of the historical pattern of development of the field in which Chomsky's ideas have been central as sort of stimulating forces for development.
Yes, I mean, I think historical factors are the most important. I think it's also one other factor, which is perhaps that some of the sort of meta-theoretical assumptions that Chomsky makes about what linguistic theory should look like seem to favor theories which posit a large number of unobservable entities. I think it's partly motivated by breakthroughs in theoretical physics, where as a paradigm for successful scientific exploration, where progress was made by positing, you know, deeper, more abstract, less observable entities, from atoms to protons and neutrons to quarks and other subatomic particles. And so this was felt to be really a paradigm case for what successful scientific exploration was meant to look like. Now, exactly those properties of being deep and unobservable are going to be properties that lead to problems with learnability. So I think there is this I'm not sure it's ever articulated in quite this way, but there's this use of theoretical physics as a paradigm success story of scientific exploration led to this particular view of syntax, and that this exacerbated the learnability problems.
Yeah, I think that's actually an important point, because Chomsky and his followers have frequently referred to their enterprises Galilean linguistics, using Galileo's revolutionary work in physics as a model, the drive towards abstract subatomic particles as a basis for advances in physics beyond relativity to quantum mechanics is certainly a model they often invoke, particularly in the minimalist program. And oddly enough, it's few, if any, of the people involved in that enterprise have ever asked or considered the question that perhaps describing human learning and cognition and the manner in which we represent cognitive objects to ourselves, both linguistic and others, might not be entirely different than the way in which the physical universe works. Even if one assumes, as we generally do, we would, I think, that the basis for all cognition and representation and learning is physical and in the brain, but the nature of the representation and learning process is not best built on analogy with mechanics, physical mechanics, and quantum mechanics.
Would it be fair to say that a major paradigm shift is going to be required for researchers in that generative tradition to acknowledge the possibility of seeing the world a different way?
That paradigm shift has been underway for at least the last 15 to 20 years, but it's been largely taking place within computational linguistics and computational learning theory and its application to problems in cognitive science. So initially what started out as an interesting sort of a statistical and probabilistic approach to language engineering has been imported into cognitive modeling and then into linguistics, except that different people are doing it. It's a younger generation that's doing it. And as is so often the case in paradigm changes, very few people who hold to one paradigm discard it and embrace another, but new generations come up in which newer methods give rise to alternative theories. And I think that that's been happening. And that, in fact, you will see if you look at journals and at conferences that the more traditional generative model is quickly becoming a minority option, and that more data-driven, stochastic, probabilistic, and Bayesian models for both language acquisition and cognitive modeling in general are very much on the rise.
Yes, I mean, I think within linguistics itself, there is also something of a paradigm shift that's been going on within the minimalist program. I mean, one of the positive aspects of the minimalist program is an attempt to reduce the number of levels of hidden representation, to get rid of deep structure and various other simplifications that do have the positive effect of making them, at least in principle, more easily learned. So I think if one looks at the formalization of minimalist syntax, which is being carried out by Ed Stabler, one can see that a suitably pared down version of that minimalist syntax in fact becomes equivalent to certain types of phrase structure grammars that can be learned from data. So I think there is a possibility for a rapprochement, though I think it's highly unlikely that sort of mainstream generative syntax is going to go down that route.
One thing that struck me is that the work of Zelig Harris seems to be referred to in a number of places, the distributional work in particular, which of course fell out of favour during the emergence of the alternative proposals of Chomsky. Do you feel that in some sense there's also a renaissance of interest in this previously neglected extant work?
Absolutely. And in fact, under the influence of the work that I've been doing with Alex, I occasionally referred to the emergence of a new paradigm, which I call the Harris-Jelinek paradigm, hyphenated after Zelig Harris and Fred Jelinek. Fred Jelinek was the computational linguist who did speech recognition work as well as statistical machine translation at IBM and then later moved to Johns Hopkins. And basically what you see then is an application of statistical modeling methods to the distributional approach of Harris, which Chomsky in 56 had thought he had dispatched, and many of the arguments, actually there's only one or two major ones that he advanced in his syntactic structures book in 57, not 56, continue to hold sway amongst hardcore generative grammarians or transformational generative grammarians, whereas in fact, those arguments have been seriously challenged by people like Pereira in a seminal paper in 2000 showing that, in fact, the kind of differences in probability of occurrence that Chomsky claimed didn't show up between sentences like green ideas sleep furiously and sleep green furiously ideas, word salads versus semantically anomalous but syntactically more or less well-formed sentences, that they actually can be predicted by more sophisticated methods that use things like smoothing that Chomsky hadn't anticipated. And there's been an explosion of work over the last 20, 30 years exactly along the lines of combining Harris's insight into distributional patterning as a key to understanding syntactic structure as well as a fair component of lexical and semantic meaning, and stochastic modeling methods that provide the engine for machine learning. And whereas these were largely inspired in the computational linguistics community by engineering concerns to develop language technology over the last 15, 20 years, certainly over the last 10 years, their role in scientific explanation, both of language acquisition and representation and cognition in general, have become enormously important. And that's I think, exactly where the paradigm change is happening. As Alex points out, the more explicit modeling work, mathematical modeling work on minimalism by Ed Stabler has also helped a great deal by clarifying the formal and computational properties of minimalist grammars. It becomes easier to formulate them in ways which allow us to see where language acquisition becomes a problem and what kind of data and what kinds of methods can be used to overcome them.
Something that strikes me about these technological developments is whether they make the argument for the poverty of the stimulus intrinsically something of its time. I'm thinking of the long quote from Chomsky that you give on Chomsky 1965 that you give on page 25 of your book, where he says, among other things, criticizing the state of empiricist work at the time, further empiricist speculations contribute nothing that even faintly suggests a way of overcoming the intrinsic limitations of the methods that have so far been proposed and elaborated. Yeah. Which sort of invites the suggestion that this argument holds for now, but at some point in the future possibly there will be solutions to these problems. Possibly Chomsky didn't at the time hold out any hope for that. Do you feel that's that in some sense this is a argument of historical interest only now?
Yes, I mean, I think that I think, to be fair, many of Chomsky's criticisms of Harris, some of which are laid out in The Logical Structure of Linguistic Theory, are very much to the mark. Because although Harris created the impression that he had a fully developed and fully articulated theory of how these distributional methods could work, in fact, when you look at them in more detail, you can see that there's a great deal of vagueness. And a large number of places where input is needed from the linguist to sort of manage this process. So I think, you know, I find myself convinced by quite a lot of Chomsky's criticisms of Harris's work as it was at the time. However, of course, you know, 1965 was quite a long time ago, and we've made a great deal of progress since then. So I think that we can, you know, take another look at these proposals and, you know, evaluate the new proposals, which may not have the flaws that the old proposals had. I think very much the same thing has happened with regard to phrase structure grammars, that Chomsky rejects phrase structure grammars as being inadequate in the late 50s and the 60s. And those criticisms, I think, were to a great extent valid. However, modern phrase structure grammar, as reintroduced by, you know, Gerald Gasdar and a number of other people in the 1980s, doesn't suffer from the flaws that the old phrase structure had. So the rejection of classical phrase structure grammar doesn't really cast any light on the validity of modern phrase structure grammar formalisms. And again, going back to Stabler's work, I think we can see that, you know, there is this convergence between the ideas in the minimalist program and ideas growing out of phrase structure grammar formalisms.
There is an interesting pattern here, though, which is that Chomsky raises very good criticisms of existing methods. So, for example, in 57, he showed quite nicely that a simple word-based bigram model for predicting syntactic structures, equivalent to a certain kind of finite state automata, was not going to work. And that argument stands, but there were much more sophisticated models around, both at the time and then subsequently, very soon after, using different kinds of finite state automata, and also using things like smoothing to account for absence of data. As Alex just pointed out, Gasdar, and then after him, people doing feature structure grammars, addressed the very important criticisms that Chomsky had brought against simple context-free grammars and showed that an enriched context-free system, perhaps more powerful, reaching a mildly context-sensitive status, but still basically a phrase structure grammar, could overcome the problems that Chomsky had pointed out, the empirical problems of dealing with certain kinds of syntactic dependency patterns very elegantly. But for some reason, the advances are never fed back into the debate on the generative side. The linguists tend to dismiss this work using the old arguments, so that's why you get this kind of splitting off of alternative paradigms, formal paradigms being pursued, often responding to Chomsky's criticisms, but the responses, which I think correct problems and show the power of a new paradigm, don't tend to go back into the mainstream of Chomsky-inspired work, which is a problem. It produces a certain lack of cohesion in the field, which is a problem.
My impression has been that there's a lot of received wisdom. In fact, turning to chapters 3 and 4 of your book, which are on the different topics, the first on the input data, the primary linguistic data, and 4 on the learnability and the goal paradigm. But in both cases, there seems to be there's a sort of received opinion that in the first place, negative evidence isn't relevant to learning. And in the second case, that these learnability results are completely strong and widespread and cannot be overcome by any reasonable means. And in both cases, you would argue that that's a misperception of kinds.
Well, yeah, I mean, the received wisdom is received only in certain quarters and repeated widely, but in other quarters doing frontline work in learning theory, computational learning theory, those results were not received for very long. In fact, it's not even clear. It seems clear that, in fact, Gold himself was perfectly aware of alternative approaches and didn't make the claims often attributed to him, at least not in the format assigned to him. And then it was our concern in the book to correct those misconceptions and to indicate that, in fact, there have been enormous advances in that Alex has referred to in computational learning theory, which shed light on the limits of learnability for classes of representation, which have never been considered by mainstream theoretical linguists, and open up new horizons for efficient learnability of fairly powerful formalisms, which are not those that are generally assumed to constitute the Chomsky heart. And this is a main point in the book.
Yes, I mean, I think that, being a little uncharitable here, one could say that if, you know, the only paper in formal language theory you ever read was, you know, Chomsky's papers from 56 and 59, and the only paper on learnability you ever read was Gold's paper from 1967, then yes, you'd see there was a huge learnability problem. But of course, there's been a huge amount of work in both fields. I think that one of the problems is that because of the direction that theoretical linguistics has taken, the study of learnability has not occupied the central place that it should have. Though Chomsky often says that, you know, we're not really interested in particular languages, we're interested in UG, you know, what the mental powers are that allow human children to acquire their native tongues. Though he puts the focus very much on a learning issue, he then turns away from any sort of study of learnability. And it's very noticeable that Chomsky himself really has said almost nothing about learnability. Almost none of his own research has been directed towards studying learnability, in any real sense. So I think there is this this sense in which, starting from these two seminal papers of Chomsky and Gold, that the received wisdom, what linguists have been taught, you know, has not really gone beyond those two papers. And if you only look at those two papers, then you're going to end up with a very misleading view of the field.
You make the case that the gold result is in many ways a very weak negative result. I mean, referring to the 67 paper that's so widely quoted.
Yes, I mean, it is a weak result. I think, obviously, you know, it was a massively important paper and really one of the first attempts to formulate the idea of learnability in a mathematically precise way. So it's unsurprising that he didn't get it absolutely right. So there are a large number of differences between the situation that the learner finds himself in Gold's model and the situation that a child finds himself in. And we devote quite a significant chunk of the book to sort of articulating those differences between the learning model and the true situation that the child finds itself in. And of course, any mathematically tractable model is going to be idealized massively and is going to differ. But I think there are a number of areas where the Gold model is particularly weak and inappropriate. And one of those really is to do with negative evidence, which I think explains the importance that negative evidence has had in the theory of language acquisition, an importance which I think really it shouldn't have. I think it's a bit of a sideshow, the issue of negative evidence.
There are two additional points, I think, that are worth making in connection with the issue that you've raised, Chris, which is one is that in the government binding period of Chomsky's framework, there was somehow a view put forward that the learning problem had been in principle solved because the number of parameters associated with universal grammar, which constitute the universal grammar, was finite and the number of values small, ideally binary, and therefore the number of possible languages or grammars for languages was finite, and hence on the Gold model was learnable, that class was learnable. And in fact, this was, as we try to argue in the book at length, I try to show that this is a serious mistake, that in fact finiteness doesn't guarantee efficiency and learnability. There are problems of a complexity which are just not dealt with in that framework. And now, interestingly enough, in the move to the minimalist framework, parameters have been increasingly downgraded to the point that in many cases, in some theories of syntax or versions of minimalism, totally jettisoned. So even this finiteness result, which was supposed to be the Gold-based key to learnability, has been discarded. And therefore, there's something of a situation of disarray in what it is that guarantees learnability in the minimalist framework. The second point, that following on from Alex's comment on negative evidence, which is Chomsky himself points out that indirect negative evidence is non-occurrence or low frequency of occurrence is itself an important source of information, but no attempt was ever made that we are aware of to, in the mainstream framework of generative grammar, to formalize that idea. We do try and develop at least an outline of a stochastic or probabilistic model of indirect negative evidence, which can compensate for the absence of direct negative evidence in an interesting way and greatly facilitate efficient learnability. And this is a fairly obvious move, and it seems surprising to us that it wasn't attempted before, although, of course, computational learning theorists have been working in this direction for a long time.
My impression that I get from reading some of the examples from the literature that you mentioned is that there are some quite significant logical errors in some prominent research drawing upon those existing computational findings and attempting to apply them to the case of generative grammars. Presumably these arise because people are not aware or kind of neglectful of some of the subtleties of the Gold approach, some of the assumptions and some of those limitations that they impose.
Yes, I mean, I think there are a number of flaws in the way that the Gold result is used. Some of them are quite obvious and some of them are quite subtle. I think one of the most important ones that we bring out in the book that hasn't really received the attention that it should have is this distinction between the learnable class that can be learned by, so the class of languages that can be learned by an algorithm, and the class of hypotheses that can be entertained by the algorithm during the course of learning. And I think this distinction is often rather blurred. And in fact, even in Gold's original paper, there's a point at which he conflates these two things. And once one understands that these two things are logically distinct, one sees that really there is a huge gap in attempts to use Gold-type results to show that the learner must have some sort of rich domain-specific knowledge of the class of languages that is available, which I think goes really to the heart of what the debate is about, namely whether there is whether linguistic nativism is really just these learnability arguments.
You take a position that I may be misrepresenting here, that the Chomsky hierarchy is overused as a source of candidate classes for natural languages. Am I correct?
Yes, that's one of our main concerns, is to show that the Chomsky hierarchy, as impressive and important as it is a piece of early piece of work on formal language theory, and in identifying a fairly natural class of languages and of automata or grammars to compute them, is by no means a sacred class or hierarchy of classes. That in fact it's possible to define classes of languages which runs more or less orthogonal towards it, that includes subsets, proper subsets of elements of different classes of the Chomsky hierarchy. So for example, you could define some of the classes that Alex has in his more technical grammar induction work. You can define classes that include some context-free grammars and some mildly context-sensitive grammars, but not all context-free or not all context-sensitive grammars. That's richly expressive and is still efficiently learnable from fairly straightforward distributional or distributionally observational data. And once you break away from the Chomsky hierarchy as the only framework within which language classes can be defined, the possibility for rich, expressively rich, but computationally efficiently learnable classes is much greater, and that opens up perspectives and horizons that weren't there before. For data-driven distributional learning, yielding interesting grammatical classes, and that's certainly a major focus of the book, is to get that point across.
Yes, I mean, I think there's one other point, really, which is that the Chomsky hierarchy is incredibly early. And so the resources that Chomsky had available to him were, in a sense, kind of limited. And so he used essentially a top-down system, a system of rewriting rules. I think, from a modern perspective, one really wants to switch to a notion of a bottom-up derivation. This is an idea which is also accepted within the minimalist program. And I think the other major flaw with the Chomsky hierarchy is that as it was so early, it entirely predates the discovery of the invention of the theory of computational complexity, which wasn't until nearly 20 years later. And so as a result, in a sense, it's missing the most important classes, which are the classes of languages that can be efficiently processed. So I think from a modern perspective, one would want to, first of all, turn the Chomsky hierarchy upside down, if you like, and view it as being a bottom-up rather than a top-down process. This gives you a hierarchy which includes things like mildly context-sensitive languages, multiple context-free grammars, and at the top, if you like, the class of languages in P time, that's the languages that can be efficiently processed. Now, once you have that sort of revised hierarchy, then one can make the move that Shalom suggests here, which is to look at classes that run orthogonal to those classes. So looking at subclasses of context-free grammars, subclasses of mildly context-sensitive languages that have the right sort of properties that will allow them to be learned. Because, one of the problems with the Chomsky hierarchy is that the class of context-sensitive languages is in completely the wrong place, really. I mean, it's in retrospect, that was just an error. But, you know, it's such an incredibly early paper that, of course, there are going to be errors in it.
It's also, just to bring out a point that's already come up, which is the difference between decidability and complexity is very important. So the Gold work was focused largely on issues of convergence, which entailed notions of decidability for grammar. Could you effectively learn a grammar with resources going towards infinity, and you were worried about basic completeness of the grammar and also the learning process converging with more or less unlimited data and time, which makes the whole paradigm far too permissive in that sense. And similar considerations apply to the Chomsky hierarchy. So you see that focus also in debates, early historical debates. So in 1973, there was a Peters-Ritchie result. So Stanley Peters and Graham Ritchie published a paper showing that 1965 transformational grammar, model of grammar from aspects was equivalent to a universal Turing machine, which indicated that it was far too powerful. It didn't give you a full completeness. It only gave you recursive enumerability, which means that it wouldn't halt for ill-formed sentences. And this was treated as a serious problem. But I mean, one of the concerns in the book is to show that really complexity is a more important problem than completeness or decidability. That you can have systems which are, you know, in their full extent undecidable, like first-order logic. But interesting and powerful subsets of representations of that system can be efficiently learned and of course decidable, the proper subsets, not the whole system. Conversely, you can have systems which are fully decidable and complete, like propositional logic, but which for purposes of computation, the complexity problem for deciding whether or not an arbitrary set of formulas is satisfiable in a model is orders of complexity too high to be efficiently computed, and the only way to solve that problem is by putting all sorts of constraints on the problem. But that's where the action lies, and we were trying to move the action from discussing often sterile discussions of questions of decidability and completeness to questions of complexity, which had been largely ignored, in part due to the focus on Gold and in part due to the focus that Chomsky had put on in the Chomsky hierarchy on those kinds of questions.
And you also point out that some of the decidability results relate to hostile presentation and learning in countable time.
No, those are learnability, convergence and learnability results that you will get. You will get serious problems of non-convergence if you allow any presentation of data. And the same problem occurs with probabilistic learning models, whereas, if you constrain the set of presentations to be friendly in a way that closely resembles the language learning situation of children being taught by parents and peers who want them to learn, then some of these problems disappear. Not all of them, and you can't make the presentation too friendly or you encode what it is, you encode too much in the data, but you do when you put interesting constraints, make the learning problem tractable, or at least open up the possibility of making it tractable in a way that comes closer to approximating the real learning situation, where most, in general, teachers don't want to frustrate learning but promote it.
Yes, I mean, I think it slightly depends on what the when you have a learning model, there's always going to be a certain amount of flexibility in how you set it up. And it really depends on what it is you're trying to do with this model. So if what you're trying to do is actually understand how something does happen, then you're going to set it up in a way that maybe is a bit more helpful for the learner, because we're trying to understand, you know, how language acquisition might take place. If, on the other hand, you're trying to show how that it can't take place in certain ways, then you might say, well, okay, we're going to require the child to learn even under quite pessimistic models. Now, the problem really is that neither of these two approaches is going to be entirely convincing to people that hold the opposite view, because what you really want to do is to show that you can learn even under a pessimistic model, or show that you can't learn even under an optimistic model. And we don't really have those sorts of results. So at the moment, really, there's a sort of spectrum of results. And under the more antagonistic ones, more adversarial ones, where the learner, the examples are being produced, if you like, by some adversary who's trying to stop the learner from learning. Under those negative results, under those pessimistic models, we have some negative results which show that it's impossible. And under more optimistic models, we have positive results. And so the situation is still, we don't have a complete characterization of the conditions under which learning can and can't take place.
Our time here is nearly up. I would like to conclude by asking, I wondered really whether you found that the book had a hostile reception from anyone in the generative tradition, or whether you find yourself almost entirely preaching to the converted.
Well, the book's been out for a little over a year, and it's hasn't gotten an enormous response from either side. So generative grammarians seem, or people who we kind of aimed it at, theoretical linguists with interest in both formal computational and psychological questions or cognitive interests, haven't responded to a great extent. Doesn't seem to yet to be on their radar screen, although there was a very favorable review in the Linguist List, and we're hoping that might bring it to the attention of the people who we want to read it. Our friends, of course, were aware of it because we sent it to them and asked them to read it and bothered them until we got a response. And these are people who are in the machine learning, computational learning, language acquisition community. But in general, what we're finding is that, and this is a comment, I think, on the sociology and culture of the field, is that unfortunately the field tends to be highly balkanized into self-contained communities. We're talking about theoretical linguistics, which reads a kind of self-generating literature, self-perpetuating literature. This book falls between the cracks and cuts across the lines, the party lines, which have been established. It does take very seriously the poverty of stimulus argument. It takes seriously Chomsky's work, doesn't try and dismiss it, sees the importance of the original insights, but then considers them in the light of more recent developments in both computational learning theory and mathematical modeling techniques, and in empirical evidence coming from psychology and biology and theoretical linguistics itself. So it really is an attempt to consider a problem from a wide multidisciplinary point of view in light of current developments, and it's not a partisan book in that sense. It does have a perspective which is promoting and identified it. For that reason, it doesn't fit neatly into any of the established schools or systems of that tend to command loyalty. Unfortunately, the field doesn't seem to respond with a great deal of interest unless it's able to identify and label contributions. And I see this as a serious problem that prevents fruitful discussion, and I'm hoping that that will change, because our book is by no means the only book of its kind, and the other attempts have been made to raise these issues in from different perspectives, but than ours perhaps. But we find there's a similar kind of lack of inclusion of let's say research that isn't clearly marked as part of a tradition by people who are in that tradition. And I think it's time that the field matured past those very strong divisions that I think stand in the way of fruitful discussion.
Yes, I mean, I think Shalom's right that there are different groups of researchers in linguistics have different sets of completely incompatible assumptions. So, for example, you have optimality theorists that have one set of assumptions. You have principles and parameters theorists. You have sort of construction grammarians and so on. And some people seem to have this viewpoint, which I find profoundly unscientific, that, well, it's fine, we can all just have our separate incompatible assumptions and we can carry on doing our research in parallel. But, of course, that's really not how science works. At some point, one needs to resolve the incompatibilities between these assumptions and figure out, well, maybe we should stop doing research on these and start doing research on something else. You can't just carry along in parallel with completely different and incompatible assumptions. At some point, you need to, you know, resolve the fundamental empirical and scientific disputes between these groups. And so what I worry about with this book is that it's just, you know, being pigeonholed as being a polemic of an empiricist type, and then, and as a result, not something that a mainstream generative grammarian should concern him or herself with. And I think that's that would be a great pity.
So what comes next for you both? Will you continue to attempt to bridge across these interdisciplinary gaps, or are you more focused on broadening and deepening the work within the tradition that you're most closely associated with?
Well, my view has always been that you follow the problem wherever it happens to lead. You don't, as a scientist and an academic or a person interested in a research project, don't need a passport to cross disciplinary boundaries. Those disciplinary boundaries are artificial, and the book, I think, is interdisciplinary in the fullest sense of the word, not as a matter of ideology, but because we wanted to consider a problem from a whole variety of perspectives. And so there's a philosophical, a computational, mathematical, a psychological, and a straight theoretical linguistic perspective, or concern, set of concerns that are followed through, with the computational being primary of modeling, but the other domains being relevant. Because it's the only way you can talk about the problem in an interesting way and consider evidence that's relevant. You can't simply rule out evidence. So my interest is to continue to follow through on these issues. I over the last couple of years sort of moved back into semantics, worrying about the problems we raise in the book. What's learnability in semantics, and what would a reasonable and efficiently learnable representation system look like? Because the problems we raise for syntax, I think, arise for all parts of linguistic representation. I hope to continue working with Alex, as well as other colleagues, on both syntax and semantics, on issues of learnability and natures of representations. But I think this kind of work can't go on just amongst linguists and psychologists and cognitive scientists and mathematicians and computer scientists have to be involved. These distinctions become increasingly uninteresting the deeper the research goes. Now, in that sense, it's kind of weird that the people who brought us the analogy between linguistics and physics are the ones often who are least inclined to follow these kinds of journeys across borders, considering work done in other fields which is directly relevant to their concerns. But I think linguistics has no choice. It's the ultimate interface field in cognitive science, and therefore has to consider this kind of work. And that means more than just looking at you know, MRIs on areas of the brain that are stimulated and announcing you found the structure that you have been arguing for in your theory of syntax. I think it means looking at work across a spectrum of domains in cognitive science using a variety of methods. Changing methods often. I've had to move from sort of categorical algebraic methods to probabilistic and stochastic models, simply because that's what's required in order to get a good handle, a good perspective on the nature of the phenomena you're studying. And I would hope we would draw our students into that perspective, because that's what it is, I think, to do research that's interesting in our field.
From my point of view, I mean, if I look back at the book now, if I have one minor criticism of the book, it's that it's generally, I think, a little negative. What it's showing there really is that a certain set of arguments that something is impossible are invalid. And showing that something is not impossible isn't quite the same as showing that it's possible. So in my current research, what I'm really trying to do is switch to a more getting positive results. I think the book was a useful, actually essential bit of sort of brush clearing, you know, clearing the intellectual territory. But I think what I'm more interested in now is actually extending various positive learnability results I've had and trying to see how close we can get them to the sorts of representations that we know we need to account for the complexities of natural language. And also trying to present them in a way that's accessible to linguists that may not have a a great deal of technical training.
Well, I wish every success to both aspects of the program. But in the meantime, let me say, Alex Clark, Shalom Levin, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
I've been talking to Alex Clark and Shalom Levin about their book, Linguistic Nativism and the Poverty of the Stimulus. This is Chris Cummins from New Books in Language. Same thing for listening.